Cloakmon. It is likely, perhaps even necessary, that my Cloakmon was entirely different from the one perceived by others. That would be Cloakmon in winter, the woolen overcoat worn at all times and from which emanated a lingering whiff of meager soup, the shawl-collared cardigan and heavy gabardine trousers, shabby, as Flynn would say, with vicissitude. The resoled work boots in which he trekked endlessly from the top of the city to the bottom and back again, the stooped comportment, bent but not beaten, the rubber handle grip of his collapsible two-wheeled cart clutched in a small, knotted hand, the exaggerated old-world features, calling to mind nothing so much as a long-suffering bat. Presented with such a figure, I will admit, one had little choice but to imagine a refugee from another century and continent. That Cloakmon was indeed such an emigre of time and place is not the point. To mistake the outward appearance for the man is to overlook the gift of his being. A small gift, seemingly meaningless, certainly insignificant in the ways that matter to most, but precious all the same, and freely given to anyone willing to set a few things down and leave them behind, anyone who would aspire to stillness and a quiet ipseity. I must confess at the outset, I stood face to face with Cloakmon only once. A little over a year ago, in order to contrive such an encounter, I intercepted a courier outside his apartment building and arranged with Flynn, the enigmatic doorman of his building, to deliver a parcel intended for him myself. Taking the back stairs to the third floor, I rang the buzzer to his flat and waited. After a few seconds of silence, I heard the sound of footsteps on floorboards, followed by the hesitant solving of locks and bolts. The door opened a few inches and Cloakmon peered out, his expression guarded though not fearful. I smiled awkwardly, holding up the package in order to explain my presence. Cloakmon opened the door further, allowing a faint scent of dried herbs and beeswax to escape the apartment. With a worldly nod, he took the box, his head wavering slightly as he looked up at me through watery brown eyes. Placing the box in the crook of his arm, he fished a 50-cent piece from the pocket of his cardigan and pressed it into my hand. Then he nodded again and closed the door quietly. I stood in the hallway for some time, staring at the silver coin in my hand even as the images glimpsed through the partly open door committed themselves to memory. The small dining table in the middle of the room, cluttered with tools and the parts of forgotten machines, box cameras, ebony mantel clocks, Bakelite radios. The mahogany and glass bookcase in the entry, filled with ancient, oversized monographs, their bindings stamped with Cyrillic characters. The tall wooden birdcage set beside an open window on the far side of the room, home to a pair of European finches whose soft, melodious warbling filled the apartment. Of Cloakmon's biography, I know next to nothing. What little I do possess in this regard came to me by way of Flynn. The time, for example, he found Cloakmon asleep on the upholstered bench in the lobby, muttering in a plaintive melange of Slavic and Romance languages. As Flynn related in his ever-lyric Bowery brogue, he maintained a respectful watch over Cloakmon's fitful sleep, during which the sequence of a traumatic flight into exile was repeatedly enumerated, an arduous itinerary stretching from Zhytomyr to a Viennese transit camp by way of Cluj, Debrecen, and Bratislava. Or the time I ventured to inquire as to the possible existence of a Cloakmon family. Staring over my shoulder as if the past were located there, Flynn simply shook his head and whispered, "Lost." Beyond this smattering of so-called facts, my knowledge of Cloakmon was gained through untold hours of careful observation, by entire days spent shadowing him on his ceaseless peregrinations. A few years ago, finding myself once again between jobs, I resolved to be unprofitable to others for as long as possible. Sitting down at my table with pen and paper, I modeled various scenarios of frugal living. According to my calculations, adopting the most extreme of these scenarios would leave me with enough money to cover room and board for at least a year. Having thus settled on a course of inaction, as it were, I set about eliminating all non-essential expenditures. Nearly everything, in other words. I canceled my pocket phone, which I then sold, along with my television, unused appliances and utensils, most of my music collection, and all but the most necessary articles of clothing. I traded in my long habit of eating out twice daily for a home-based diet of bread, jam, dairy staples, greens and root vegetables, tomatoes, berries. In place of the prepackaged liquids one can otherwise no longer avoid, I drank tap water and fresh milk. I closed myself to the media and its preferred forms of unedifying distraction, cinema, television, sporting events, passing my time instead rereading the books already on my shelves, listening to the handful of LPs I hadn't sold, and taking in the endless film that is city life. I roamed by bicycle and on foot, exploring neighborhoods and ways of life I had formerly overlooked or purposely ignored. For the most part, though, I spent my time on stoops and park benches, watching the constant parade of people, cataloging gestures and behaviors and snippets of passing conversation in a small notebook. I spent as much time looking up as around, my thoughts given over to a kind of phenomenological consideration of clouds and treetops, of migrating birds and far-off airplanes, and endeavoring to decode the accidental baroque of jagged, cluttered rooftops. It was during this period that I first encountered Cloakmon, one late summer morning at the farmer's market in the park near my apartment. I stood in line at one of the dairy stalls waiting to purchase the week's butter and eggs. As I neared the front of the queue, I let my attention sink from the ambient sound collage floating above the busy market to ground level, where it settled on the truly diminutive form of the old man in front of me. His entire being, body, presence, aura, seemed built to a completely different scale than the rest of us. Bent slightly at the waist, his shoulders hunched, there was nevertheless something noble and upright in his bearing. Casting a quick glance at the sagging skin of his elbows below his rolled-up shirt sleeves, I judged him to be about 80. His clothing, from the coarsely woven muslin of his summer-weight shirt, to the navy linen of his roomy trousers, to the soft felt of his beret, was like a museum of bygone fabrics. I was struck above all by his posture of languid repose as he waited to pay for his things. He seemed to me a kind of living hiatus, a benign subtraction from the sum of things, his near-perfect absence merely serving to make him seem more firmly there. In time, I came to understand that he was, in fact, the most fully present and worthwhile person in a world peopled by hollow, shabby specters. Though I had yet to see the face of this gnomic being, His slight stature allowed me to look directly over him and into the face of the young woman seated at the checkout table. Reflected on her friendly countenance as if in a mirror, I caught my first glimpse of what I came to think of as Cloakmon's beatitude. He purchased his things, 3 small cheeses, a 6 bluish eggs, a 1 pint of fresh cream, with a gestural purity that felt like the casting of a spell. The quiet murmuring of earnest pleasantries, the almost apologetic passing of bills and waving off of change, the gentle stowing of perishables in the small soft cooler nestled in his wire cart, the humble touch of thumb to forehead by way of farewell. Spell it must have been. I stood motionless for what seemed a lifetime, completely transfixed. I felt light, empty, insubstantial, yet somehow completely grounded, more firmly anchored to the here and now than I had ever been. As I tried to make sense of this strange sensation, I realized that the little man who'd so beguiled me had slipped away. In the blink of an eye, my tranquility decayed to near panic. I still had much to learn. Jerking my head this way and that, I searched the stalls and busy pathways. I spotted him at the far side of the park just as he turned the corner and out of sight. There was no question that I should follow him. I needed to see more of him, needed to watch him be. Setting my things down in front of the still smiling young woman, I apologized lamely, mumbling something about having forgotten my wallet, then rushed to the spot where he'd disappeared from view. I needn't have hurried. As I soon learned, Cloakmon was perhaps the slowest moving person in the city. It wasn't a matter of age or infirmity. His gait was perfectly regular, elegant even. A pure ambler, his pace was not designed to cover ground, to get from place to place. It was a place. He was, I believe, so perfectly at home in himself that he simply had no need of hurrying off to some vague elsewhere. At the time, however, I was surprised to find, upon reaching the corner, that he'd covered barely 10 feet of sidewalk. Practically skidding to a stop, I stood beside a signpost and waited. Nearly a minute passed before he gained enough distance for me to safely follow him. I took a few deep breaths to calm myself, then set off. With considerable effort, I managed to align my pace with his and thus maintain the distance between us. He ambled, I followed. My education had begun. It took 15 minutes to cover the 2 blocks from the farmer's market to his apartment building. During that time, I completed the introductory lesson on time. Walking in concert with Cloakmon, without haste, without goal, without obvious purpose, had the effect of installing a different relation to time. I felt like a boulder in a river, an outcrop of fixedness set against a raging torrent, in contact with the flow but not flowing, observing but unobserved. The strange feeling of weightless rootedness returned, a wonderful sensation. And yet, I sensed there was more going on than just this novel experience of time. Somehow, I understood that the state of being engendered by this experience, the slowness, the drift, the feeling of solid transparency, was not the goal. It was merely the first step. For it was already clear that Cloakmon, in addition to his ability to stand apart in the flow of time, possessed a different kind of sight. His head roamed constantly, from side to side, up and down, along the diagonal, his gaze directed sometimes near, sometimes far. Occasionally, he stopped altogether and appeared to observe a single person or thing for quite some time. I tried, on such occasions, to determine the object of his focus, to see what he was seeing, to understand what it was that had captured his attention, but always failed. Once he stopped for nearly a minute to regard an empty patch of rapidly warming sidewalk. I stared at it too, eagerly awaiting the epiphany that was sure to come, but managed to discern only grit and cigarette ends and an unsightly model of grease stains and pickled chewing gum. Before I knew it, the amble was over. Veering suddenly from the sidewalk, Cloakmon crossed the street and made for a red brick building. The doorman, noticing the little man's approach, held the door open respectfully. Acknowledging this courtesy with a little bow, Cloakmon slipped inside. I stood across the street and waited in the hopes that he would reemerge so that I might resume following him, continue watching him be. After half an hour or so, I gave up and left. Even a person such as me has things to do, after all. Well, perhaps not so many things. The next morning, I found myself standing in the very same spot. I arrived not a moment too soon, as a couple minutes later, Cloakmon emerged from the darkened lobby. He was dressed much as the day before, though he'd traded his wire cart for a large canvas rucksack. I settled in behind him, eager to follow wherever he would lead, to look wherever he would look. There is no way to communicate the full measure of that day. I can offer only fragments, moments connected to objects taken from the rucksack. The leafy neighborhood park through which Cloakmon drifted for nearly half an hour, head roaming freely atop his stooped shoulders, eventually taking a seat on a bench on the far side, removing a cloth-bound sketchbook and pen from his rucksack and transferring his impressions to paper with a quick, sure hand. The sudden shower, Cloakmon pulling a small umbrella from the pack but not bothering to use it, instead turning his face to the falling rain, this commonplace occurrence a genuine miracle to him, his arms spread wide so as to catch it in his upturned palms, afterwards zigzagging along the sidewalk and stepping in each and every puddle. The chance encounter with a large homeless man, a polar explorer fallen out of time and space with his ear-flapped hat and redundant parkas and makeshift puttees. Cloakmon producing a packet of small sandwiches, no doubt meant to serve as his own sustenance for the day, and handing them over before ambling humbly away. I shadowed him thus for 2 years, perhaps a little longer. I'm certain he knew I was there. He had to have seen me, though in all that time he never gave any indication of it. 2 years of days, each day a lifetime. Lifetimes during which I finally learned to see, and in seeing, to be. Being, at bottom, is simply the manner in which you respond to the implausible, miraculous fact that you are here. To be is to square your response to this fact with the fact itself. Cloakmon showed me a way of being I had only guessed at. He indicated the path that led to myself and how to cleave to it, taught me how to find everything in what others take for nothing. Thanks to his example, I am. I watch, I listen, I eat, I read, I record impressions. I amble. It's enough. At some point, I became aware of the fact that Cloakmon, small as he might have been, was nevertheless losing mass. Indeed, from 1 month to the next, there seemed to be more of his clothing and less of him. I began to fear that he might disappear altogether. One quiet gray morning, a soft rain was falling. I slipped into my spot opposite his apartment. Flynn, dressed in black, performed his duties in a lifeless, desultory manner. Eventually, he looked across at me. He stared into the space between us for some time, his arms hanging limply at his sides. Poor Flynn. The sorrowful shake of head, the forlorn dip of chin to chest, were as eloquent a eulogy as any that could be uttered. Saddened, but somehow not surprised, I acknowledged Flynn with a Cloakmon-esque bow, then turned and ambled off. The world is slop and folly. There is not much to be done about that. I have no doubt that Cloakmon endured his share of hardship, that life served him a full measure of suffering and pain. He tangled with life, it was clear, and the encounter had left its mark. But it had not finished him. He survived life's onslaught, sidestepped it, let it thunder past. He managed to carve out a space not much bigger than himself and slip inside. There he lived the fullest life possible. Who knew he was even there? Maybe Flynn, perhaps only me. And who knows that I am here? No one, really.